Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Under the Radar SFF Books Podcast. I'm your host, Blaze, as always. Thank you so much for listening and joining me wherever you may be around the world. And today, I'm going to be starting a new series on my podcast titled A Chapter a Day. Now, let me give you some background information on what this series is all about, why I decided to bring it to my podcast, and the inspiration for it. So, A Chapter a Day is basically me reading a section or several sections of books to you in order for you to gain more of a perspective, influence, and understanding of what the authors are trying to do in a given series. Because it's one thing for me to just sit up here and say how much I love a series, you need to read it for X, Y, and Z, so on and so forth. It's another thing for me to actually show you. And the way to show you in this instance is by reading certain parts from this book. And I have two such books for you today. I'm going to be reading the prologues. But a little bit of background before this. So as a recent participant, I was actually a judge in the SPIFFO competition. For those of you who don't know what SPIFFO stands for, it is Self-Published Fantasy Blog Off. And the way we judged certain books in our categories, us as a blog was responsible for reading 30 books in 5 or 6 months. We decided to read 20 or 25% of a book to determine if it was worthy of continuing on. Now, I know some reviewers and readers in the SPIFFO competition narrow that down to maybe a chapter, or in some extreme cases, even just the first page. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that short of a reading section to tell you how much you would like or dislike a book. I think you need more time, but I thought I would split the difference. So I would read a certain chapter for books that I love over the years, and I think you guys will enjoy them as well. And just two more things before we actually get started. I'm not actually going to tell you before I start reading from the book the title or the author. So it's going to be, you guys are going to be going in completely blind on this. I will, however, tell you the subgenre of the book that I'm reading, just some more information. And another thing, I'm going to be trying to do at least one of these a week, sometimes more, sometimes less, because these should be relatively quickly for me to get out. So please sure to let me know if you guys enjoy this, either through my blog or on my podcast or even on my Twitter, or as it's called now, X handle. And then we should have a lot of fun with this. So I'm going to read from you from the first book. It is an epic fantasy book, and it's actually one of my top 10 series of all time. And I just love the author to pieces. So stick with me, and I'm going to read from the prologue right now. I stood there and wept. I wept not because I had lost so much privilege, my lands, my sigil, and my rank. I was once the second prince, and thus second in line to the throne of the greatest kingdom the world had ever seen. I was second prince and born with all the advantages accorded to one of my noble birth. But I was second prince no more, and no longer able to claim that lofty title. Yet it was not for having lost the position of second prince that I wept. Losing my inheritance was lamentable, but that loss could have been even sadder, as I could have lost my head along with my rank. Certainly, that would have saddened me. Still, all that loss was not why I wept. I wept because no one lived that might cut off my head any more. I wept, crushed by the enormity of it all. I wept, for none of it was supposed to happen. God help me, I thought, as I envisioned the children, worst of all. It was not supposed to happen to our precious, beloved children, all the little ones of our realm, innocents, with guileless, laughing faces, who'd lived faultless lives, not yet familiar with sin, all snuffed out. My heart was shattered thinking of them. They were just babes. I wanted to shriek in agony, cry out at the unresponsive, intransient, uncaring waters, at the unfairness of them all being gone. I prayed for the tens of thousands of souls, and especially for our children. I finished my prayer and made the sign of the triangle and the circle, the symbol of our faith, to solidify my devotion. I touched a notch in my throat with my right hand's index finger, drew a line diagonally to my right nipple, then another line across to my left nipple, and then back up to my throat. With that same finger resting on my throat for a moment, I drew an imaginary circle on my chest that would surround the triangle counterclockwise until I reached my throat again. That was the sign, the warding, the invocation of our single God, whom I prayed would take the poor dear children into his bosom. That sign was known all over the known world, amongst the godly and the pagan. It was the most revered sign on the earth, invented by the most revered priest to walk that earth, who was the father of the founder of our race. I wondered how our founder's father, who perished at the hands of his own son, had felt as he offered himself to the blade of martyrdom. Was he scared in his last moments? Was he in the ecstasy of sacrifice, of knowing that in death he would soon be close to the single God? Was he blinded by hatred of his own son for his murder? I knew something of hatred between fathers and sons and thought it was a distinct possibility. Had he felt humbled and unworthy that he should be the catalyst for ensuring our people found their way to the true God? Just as the knife plunged down into his breast, had he felt betrayed by the single God that he must give up his life? Did he have a crisis in faith in his last moments? Had he felt deserted, as I did under the weight of my responsibilities, despite all those I had with me and all the potential that lay before me? Had he felt alone? I was alone too, except for the few men who were steering the ship or tending to the sail above deck with me. I was alone, save for the rest below in the berth, who likely slept, at least those who could find sleep amidst the nightmares. In my mind, I could picture my survivors in that below deck, screaming, some wordlessly, their voices too hoarse to make any sound, their eyes bulged in horror, their faces constricted in rage, grief, and despair. I stood at the bow of my ship, the proud stern. From the bow, I had a solitary view of the dark, endless sea. Dawn neared, and with it our proximity to new lands. My proud stern was the flagship of a fleet of 18 sailing galleys whose oars were all drawn up. So 17 long hulls were arrayed behind proud stern as she sliced through the shimmering sea. Sails stiffened in favorable wind. Our 18 ships were a pittance of what we islanders were. At its height, our navies numbered almost 3,000 ships. Yet our 18 ships carried all who were presumed to have survived from our kingdom. Each ship carried 100, for a total of 1,800 persons. I was alone, but for 1,800 of my people, the last of our kind, I was alone, and my sole accountability for all their fates, for good or for ill. I do not wish to be a martyr, like the founder's father, but I would willingly die to protect all of them, if I needed to. The reason we almost 2,000 persons had left the kingdom and thus lived, while all the other people had stayed and died, was that we, the survivors, were rebels. We were traitors to the tri-crown, the majestic three-part head adornment, part prelate's cap, part warrior's helm, part king's coronet, worn by the monarchs of our island for more than 5 centuries, which represented my family's royal power. And I, who was once second prince, was the head of the rebels. It was ironic that I, Othrun, should be called a revolutionary, much less a revolutionary leader. I was the namesake of a man known for inaction, who had a reputation for avoiding trouble at all costs, a man who lived would not have rebelled against his wife's suggestion of what choice to have for supper, much less revolt against the mightiest realm on earth. While I was not known to be a sluggard like the author and I was named for, and considered myself a vigorous man, no one would have believed that my considerable energy would be turned traitorous. But I took the treachery against my lawful king with such apparent zeal, so ably, as if treason ran naturally in my blood, and was bequeathed to me by the indolent Othrun I was named for. I made up for any sloth on that part of that other Othrun. I showed myself to be a man of bolder action than any in recent memory, for I had done the unthinkable. I denounced the royal sovereign, formed a plan for insurrection against him, and raised arms against the Tri-Crown. More than that, I lived to tell the tale. If there had been anyone left except the 1800 with me to write the chronicle, I would have gone down in my kingdom's annals as the most infamous man of my generation. But the cost of my infamy left me, despite any opportunity it presented me, bereft, despondent, and almost numb. Yet, while I was torn apart inside by the ineffable catastrophe, I would do the same again, many times over. I was a lord, a king, and a faithful supplicant of the single God, the one God, the God of life, love, and light. I was a man who broke his oaths to his king to keep his vows to his God. I was shattered, reduced to nothing, but I was still here, thanks to that God and that God's messenger. Meanwhile, that king I rebelled against, who had forsaken all he should love and all that he should revere, was no more. But I, Othron, 1 second prince, lived, and I had nearly 2,000 followers, the last of our kind. I had youth, strength, and wits. I also had a promise to encourage me, promise of greatness. But that promise was achieved by rebellion, a rebellion sprung from lust, betrayal, and blood. That prologue sure does get you, doesn't it? This book that I read from is none other than Drowned Kingdom by P.L. Stewart. This is book number one in his Drowned Kingdom saga. There's two other books published in this series, and the third one is, The fourth one is looking to be published in spring of next year. So if you liked what I said about this book, pick this up. It's known for its epic scope. It's known for its great world building. It's really a classical type of prose, very similar to Robert Jordan and Wheel of Time. And I think you guys will actually like this one. And the next one I have, and this is the final one for today's episode, this is also an epic fantasy novel, and it's also one of my top series of all time. I actually love the author, and I actually interviewed him on the podcast. So we'll talk about that afterwards. So here's the prologue. Rot. It was the rot, Tanis reflected as he stared down into his daughter's eyes, that had taken his child. Screams and imperfections, pleading and sobbing, shivered the air as the long lines of prisoners filled the valley. The scent of blood and urine thickened in the noon heat. Tanis ignored it all, focusing instead on the face of this daughter of his who knelt, clutching at his knees. Faith was a woman grown now, 30 years and a month. At a casual glance, she might have passed as healthy. Bright gray eyes, lean shoulders, strong limbs, but the Sistrium no longer bore healthy children, not for centuries. Father, the woman begged, tears streaming down her cheeks. Those tears, too, a symptom of the rot. There were other words for it, of course. The children, in their ignorance or innocence, called the affliction age. But in this, as in so much else, they erred. Age was not decrepitude. Tanis himself was old, hundreds of years old, and yet his sinews remained strong, his mind nimble. If needed, he could run all day, all night, and the better part of the next day. Most of the Sistrium were older still, thousands upon thousands of years, and yet they continued to walk the earth, those who had not fallen in the long wars with the Navarium. No, time passed, stars swung through the silent arcs, seasons gave way one to the next, and yet none of these, in and of itself, brought harm. It was not age, but rot that gnawed at the children, consuming their bowels and brains, sapping strength, eroding what meager intelligence they once possessed. Rot, and then death. Father, Faith pleaded, unable to proceed past that single word. Daughter, Tanis replied. You don't, she gasped, glancing over her shoulder toward the ditch, toward where the Dorensi went about their work, steel flashing in the sunlight. You can't. Tanis cocked his head to the side. He had tried to understand this daughter of his, tried to understand all the children, though he was no healer. As a soldier, he had learned long ago to tend shattered bones and ruptured skin, to treat the festering flesh that came from a soiled wound or the raking costs of men too long in the field. And yet this, he could no more comprehend the nature of this decay than he could cure it. It was you, daughter, that rot has you. He reached down and ran a finger across along the creases in Faith's forehead. Sketch the delicate tracery of lines beside her eyes. Lifted a slender filament of silver hair from the brown locks. Just a few decades of sun and wind had already begun to roughen her smooth olive skin. He had wondered, when she first burst from between her mother's thighs, strong lunged and screamed, if perhaps she might grow up unscathed. The question had intrigued him, and now it was answered. It touches you gently, he pointed out, but its grip will grow stronger. And so you have to do this, she exploded, jerking her head desperately toward the freshly turned earth ditch. This is what it comes to. Tanis shook his head. It was not my decision. The council voted. Why? Why do you hate us? Hate? He replied. That is your word, child, not ours. It's not just a word. It describes a feeling, a real thing, a truth about the world. Tanis nodded. He had heard such arguments before. Hate, courage, fear. Those who thought the rot and affliction merely of the flesh understood nothing. It corroded the mind as well, rusting the very foundations of thought and reason. I grew from your seed, Faith continued, as though that followed logically from what came before. You fed me when I was small. This is the way of many creatures, wolves, eagles, horses, when they are young, dependent. All must rely on their progenitors. Wolves, eagles, and horses protect their children, she protested. Weeping openly now, clawing at the backs of his legs, I've seen it. They guard and tend, feed and nurture. They raise their young. She reached a trembling, imploring hand toward her father's face. Why will you not raise us? Wolves, Tanis replied, brushing away his daughter's hand, raise their young to be wolves. Eagles, eagles. You, he continued, frowning once more, we have raised you. But you are broken, polluted, compromised. You can see it for yourself, he said, gesturing to the hunched, defeated forms that stood waiting in the rim of the pit. Hundreds of them, just waiting. Even without this, you would die on your own, and soon. But we are people. We are your children. Tanis shook his head wearily. It was no good reasoning with one whose reason had decayed. You can never be what we are, he said quietly, drawing his knife. At the sight of the blade, Faith made a strangling sound deep in her throat and flinched away. Tanis wondered if she would try to run. A few did. They never made it far. This daughter of his, however, did not run. Instead, she balled her hands into white, trembling fists, and then, with an obvious effort of will, straightened from her knees. Standing, she was able to look him directly in the eye, and though tears plastered her hair to her cheeks, she no longer wept. For once, however, briefly, the disfiguring terror had left her. She looked almost whole. Hail. And you cannot love us for what we are, she asked. Words slow, steady for the first time. Even polluted, even broken, even rotten. You cannot love us? Love, Tanis repeated, tasting the strange syllable, revolving it on his tongue as he drove the knife in and up, past the muscle, past the ribs, into her galloping heart. Like hate, it is your word, daughter, not ours. So that little passage is the prologue for Brian Staveley's The Emperor's Blades. The Emperor's Blades is the first book in the Chronicles of the Hyun-Hyun Throne, completed trilogy at that, and there's actually a sequel trilogy which just has the first book published, I believe it was 2 years ago. One great trilogy to read. A little background on that prologue. That took place many centuries before the actual start of the series, and talks about the Sistrium and the Novarium, two races which are no longer on Earth. It's just humans, but that's just a little bit of the hate filled in this book. So those are the two books I wanted to share with you today. I'm going to have plenty more coming in the next few weeks. Readers and listeners, if you have some passages of your favorite books that people need to listen to and would like for other people to discover, please send me a link to them and what passage you would like me to read. I'm more than happy to put them on air. Authors, if you're listening, feel free to reach out to me if there's a passage from your book you would like me to read to my podcast and audience members. And I'd love to work with you. This should be a fun and exciting series. Please let me know your feedback on it. And of course, as always, cheers, everybody.